The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 28th of October 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
Time and again throughout our history, we've seen charlatans, the con men, the phony populists who sought to play on our fears.
Joe Biden goes on the offensive as he takes his presidential campaign to Georgia. But can he make inroads in traditional Republican territory? We'll also be speaking to the journalist Iona Craig as the United Nations issues a grave warning over food shortages in Yemen. Plus, Bloomberg's Ewan Potts will join us for an update on the markets. And then a little bit later on today's show.
I'm Monocle's Nick Manise, and I'll be talking about Pakistan's first metro line and a fundraiser for rebuilding Beirut.
All that right here on The Briefing with me, Andrew Tuck. The Democratic Party's presidential hopeful Joe Biden has launched a full-throttle assault on Donald Trump's character as the US election enters its final phases. Biden told voters in Georgia that Trump was a con man who had tarnished America's international reputation. Let's have a listen.
Time and again throughout our history, we've seen charlatans, the con men, the phony populists who sought to play on our fears, appeal to our worst appetites, and pick at the oldest scabs we have for their own political gain. They appear when the nation's been hit the hardest and we're at our most vulnerable. Never to solve anything, but only to benefit themselves.
That was Joe Biden on the campaign trail in Warm Springs, Georgia. Well, let's get the latest now with Scott Lucas, professor of US politics at the University of Birmingham here in the UK. Thanks for joining us, Scott. He's taking the fight right to the Trump heartland, and the language there was almost that of somebody who feels that they've got the job already, because he sounded incredibly confident. And when you look at the speech, it's full with kind of religious references. You know, there's a real sense that he feels he's the man for the moment. Explain to us what you think the significance is of this speech, and also of why he's gone to Georgia and why he feels that he could potentially take this state.
Well, I got something a bit different out of the speech. I mean, you got the quick headlines about the challenge to Donald Trump, including Trump's actions, Trump's rhetoric, the con man line. But the one that struck me was the positive, which is Biden calling for a time to heal. That time to heal is from Ecclesiastes in the Bible, as you mentioned. And it is a reference from biblical times to now of coming out of dark times, coming out of division, coming out of turmoil. And of course, in this case, in the middle of a pandemic. And I think this call for unity and responsibility is something which for me is beyond Joe Biden. It's beyond Donald Trump. It's beyond Democrat and Republican. It's a necessary message for all Americans. But to bring it back to the campaign specifically, to do this in Georgia, which is where my family is from, which is normally a deep red Republican state, but in recent years has been trending purple. In other words, more people have been moving towards the Democratic Party, people in the suburbs, people in the cities, young people. This is the sense of Biden and his vice presidential running mate, Kamala Harris. They can win this state. And of course, if they win Georgia, you're talking not only about a Biden victory on November the 3rd over Donald Trump, you're pointing to a possible Biden landslide and the Democrats taking control of Senate and the Congress.
And just tell me, what is the campaign trail like for both men over the coming days? What are the states that they need to visit to try and shore up votes, to persuade voters, the final voters haven't already cast their ballots, to come in their direction?
It's a real interesting difference between the two. And the first is that the Biden campaign, which is ahead in most of the swing states, the key states that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, but also ahead in Republican Arizona, as we mentioned, neck and neck in Georgia, neck and neck in Iowa, and ahead in Florida, Ohio, and North Carolina. So you've got Biden really only appearing about 3 to 4 times each week. He's not doing daily campaign stops, because then you have Kamala Harris, who's in Arizona today, and you've got people like a guy named Barack Obama, who's campaigning hard in Florida for Biden this week. So you've got them, I think, sort of rolling with steady as she goes. And then you've got Trump. It's the Trump show. I mean, it is Donald Trump, not even Vice President Mike Pence, but Trump pretty much doing 3 and 4 states in a day, having these rallies, defying coronavirus by packing people together and hoping that the force of his personality and the headlines from his insults and sometimes his disinformation can overtake Biden. It is, I think, another division between spectacle and responsibility. But the stakes are even greater now than they were in 2016.
Biden, as we said, he seems to want to focus just on Trump, on Trump's record. And it feels like the coronavirus story is the most pertinent of those things to hit Trump with. Do you think it is almost coming down now to a vote about that issue, about, you know, how has President Trump handled this pandemic? Because that seems to be the thing that they see as his real Achilles heel.
I think coronavirus is the central issue. I think the Trump campaign didn't want it to be. They know it's difficult to win on that, given now moving on to almost 230,000 Americans killed, almost 9 million cases, and the rate is still about 1,000 Americans dying each day. And we've got record cases, the highest since the pandemic started. So they wanted to talk about culture wars, or they wanted to talk about Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett, or they wanted to talk about, anything apart from the pandemic. But Trump contracting the virus and then just the sheer scale of the negligence of this meant they can't shift it. But it's not just coronavirus, because think about through the summer, the highlighting of the racial and social issues around Black Lives Matter. Think about an economic downturn, which is the greatest in American recorded history. This is the most critical election since 1945. And so I think that overriding issue, of which the pandemic is part, which is who has responsible, who's competent? And how can we get back to competence in American life rather than division and almost a downward spiral of us versus them politics?
It's good to hear that Biden wants to heal these terrible kind of rifts within U.S. society. But, as we say, he goes on the attack, and I'm standing behind Trump and many supporters who can't stand Biden and still will believe in the Trump version of America. Do you think that Biden has any real hope of kind of healing those rifts? Because the other interesting thing is he will take over management of the pandemic, and it's so out of control in many countries, including the US. It's hardly likely that going into winter, in the new year, he will still be able to kind of turn around the story very quickly if he wins. And he is then going to be faced with massive unemployment. And even then, the divisions over race and the Black Lives Matters movement, they're not simple things to fix. Is he going to be one of those presidents who comes in on a wave of hope, but actually has very little room to maneuver?
It's a long road back. I mean, America's a country which has been increasingly divided over the past decades. But especially since 2017, in addition to the guy in the White House, it's a very poisonous media atmosphere in many respects, compounded by, social media and the second by second, almost barrage sometimes of disinformation. It's a country which has been rocked on its heels coming out of a recession because some people didn't benefit over the past few years. It's a country which has not dealt with its racial differences effectively. But having said all that, we saw the day after Donald Trump took office, you know, millions of people in the Women's March who said, we've got to find a better way. We saw millions of people in 2018 after the shootings in Parkland, Florida, say, we need a better way. We've seen people this summer say, you know, we need a better way back. And I can't guarantee that's going to triumph, because every day, you know, from foreign interference in elections to just simply sheer lies about the pandemic itself. But a lot of people out there want a better way. And as long as that's there, yeah, there's hope of a dawn out of a period which has been quite dark at times in America in the past few years.
And just in a couple of words, is your feeling now that a Biden victory is in the bag?
No, you never say that. I mean, the best site out there, 538.com, has Biden as a 7-1 favorite, and I think that's about right. But it's not just the fact that, you know, Donald Trump could overcome this with a surge on Election Day. It's that Donald Trump will not recognize a Biden victory and will try to cling onto that office unless it's a Biden landslide. So, you know, even Biden winning on November the 3rd is the start of another chapter where Donald Trump will try to stay in office and will try basically to say that everyone who tries to oppose him is part of this fake media that you and I are part of as well.
Well, Scott, thank you. That was the US political expert, Scott Lucas. Now here's Monocle's Yulene Goffin with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. The UK government has called on NATO to stand shoulder to shoulder on values of tolerance and free speech. It comes as Turkey urges its citizens to boycott French goods following a row over free expression. Israel and Lebanon are preparing to hold a second round of US-mediated talks over their disputed sea border. The longtime foes held preliminary discussions over their maritime grievances earlier this month. Melbourne's shops, restaurants and hotels have reopened for business after a four-month lockdown. Shopkeepers in Australia's second most populous city hope the easing of restrictions will help make up for lost revenue. And today's Monocle Minute reports on Lahore's metro network, which is a first for Pakistan. The new system has dozens of stations and will serve about 250,000 people each day. To find out more, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Yulene. Well, the United Nations is warning that Yemen is facing a grave security crisis this winter. The organization says that the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and sharp economic decline have exacerbated the situation in a country that's already been ravaged by years of civil war. Well, I'm joined now for more on this by the journalist Iona Craig. Iona spent the first 3 months of this year in Yemen. Welcome back to the briefing, Iona. 6 years of war. Before we go into the current crisis, just tell us what the state of play is on the ground at the moment. What is the situation in Yemen?
Well, right now you've got the conflict continually to get bogged down, get more and more complex. Most immediately, the northeastern city of Marib is one of the most contested areas at the moment. Equally, the fighting on the west coast around the port of Hodeidah, which is vital for humanitarian aid, has also escalated in recent weeks. And this conflict that the Saudi-led coalition initially thought would be over within a few weeks of the air war being launched back in March 2015 is continuing unabated really now, well into its sixth, approaching its seventh year. And the prospect of any political resolution to it at the moment, or even a ceasefire right now, looks very, very remote.
Now, this feeling that there's going to be a food security crisis, there's a kind of perfect storm of issues coming into play. Could you explain to listeners what's happening that's exacerbating the situation even more?
Well, there's a combination of factors that come into play over recent months and certainly since the beginning of this year. One of them is primarily the pandemic that everybody is facing worldwide, but is hitting Yemen in a couple of ways. And one of those is from remittances. Yemeni families have become increasingly reliant over the course of the civil war on money from family members abroad, from Yemeni expats who are working primarily in Saudi Arabia, but also in the Gulf and elsewhere in the world, sending that income back home to families who need it to survive, as well as propping up the economy by sending in US dollars into Yemen, and that stabilizes the currency as well. So those have fallen dramatically because of the pandemic, because of COVID-19. Add to that, UN agencies have had huge problems as well. There has been defunding of programs over the last 6 months, really. The donor conference earlier this year fell very short of the money that the UN was hoping to gather. And in fact, by middle of October, the UN has received just 1.4 billion of the over 3 billion needed for humanitarian aid projects in Yemen. Add to that the depreciation of the currency. The Yemeni rial is now worth, it's 820 Yemeni rials to the dollar in southern Yemen, where these latest figures have come from about acute malnutrition. In the north, it's slightly better. It's 600 Yemeni rials to the dollar. Bearing in mind, before the war, it was 270. So you're seeing a depreciation of the currency, which results in rising food prices. You've got less capacity for people to purchase food and less salary and income for families in order to be able to survive. And so it's a combination of all that factors, which, as you say, creates this perfect storm. And it does mean that less people now are getting support from the World Food Programme, for instance. Their latest sort of supplies to people in Yemen for food assistance reached 5.7 million. And that was a decrease in 2 million people from previous months. So they're less able to provide food assistance for people when they need it most.
Ayanna, what is the potential way ahead here? You know, I'm sure you've spoken to people on the ground when you were there who have some idea of how the country could move ahead. But is there any hope at this time of a proper peace, of some settlement that would allow the country to feed itself, to stop being so dependent on aid agencies, and to allow its kids to stop starving, to put it bluntly?
Well, this is the problem. Ultimately, it needs a resolution to the conflict in order to solve these long-standing problems. And, you know, the UN Special Envoy, Martin Griffiths, has been repeatedly attempting for years now to reach some kind of political agreement. But we've seen in recent weeks even the prisoner swap that ended up being a fraction of the size, as in numbers, of prisoners swap that it was originally supposed to be, and was due to happen more than a year ago. So even to do a mechanism like that was supposed to be a step forward in the right direction for a kind of political talks as a confidence building measure, it took a year longer to get there than it should have done. So even the simplest kind of negotiations, or what should be the simplest, are taking a huge amount of time and effort. So getting even anywhere near to political discussions does unfortunately seem a long way off. But you know, I first started reporting on hunger in Yemen back in 2012 in Hodeidah on the West Coast. And that was as a result of the Arab Spring and the revolution in Yemen at that point. So Yemen is very susceptible to even small, what we would see, well, it was significant, obviously, but by comparison to a war, a small impact of political upheaval like that on the civilian population. So it is incredibly important that there is a resolution to the conflict for this to be able to ease. But in the meantime, it's about the UN agencies trying to get more money, trying to fill that funding gap between that 1.43 billion that they've received and the 3.2 billion that they do need. Because whilst there isn't a resolution to the conflict, whilst there isn't a ceasefire, people are going to continue to go hungry without that kind of support.
Ayanna, thank you for joining us. That was the journalist and Yemen analyst Ayanna Craig. And you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. We're going to be right back after this.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You're back with a briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck. Well, let's get a roundup of the day's latest business headlines now. And I'm joined on the line by Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. Ewan, great to have you back on the show. Very much a down day for markets. I can think of lots of things pushing them down. But what's the trigger today?
Yeah, European stocks slumping today, falling to a five-month low. That says rising coronavirus infections and tougher lockdowns add to worries about the economic hit from the pandemic. Says in France down 3.2% at the moment, Germany down 3.5%, everything in the red. Now, the trigger in particular today, the announcement by Chancellor Angela Merkel of tougher curbs on movement and contacts in Germany, including closing bars, restaurants and leisure facilities to the end of November. Now, of course, a lot of countries around Europe have looked on Germany as a model of success in dealing with the coronavirus over the last 6 months or so. So I think it's really bringing home to investors that even Germany is now facing a coronavirus crisis, rising infections going up rapidly and more lockdown measures as we're seeing pretty much everywhere else in Europe. I think there had been some feeling that stock markets, particularly US stock markets, had been rather detached from the grim reality that many people have been facing in their lives over the last 6 months. But certainly, it looks like markets are coming down with a bump today.
And some interesting US data coming as well. What will that show today?
Yeah, this number is likely to prove very welcome for one of the candidates in next week's election. And my guess is he'll have something to say about it. Now, data due later today will show that US gross domestic product surged an annualized 32% in the third quarter. That's the fastest growth on record, almost double the previous high. But the headline number, like the record contraction which preceded it, does obscure some key parts of the story. Now, the good news is that US consumers and the housing markets have really proved resilient over the last few months. That's been a great big boost to the US economy. But the pace of growth has moderated significantly since early on in the recovery. And the economy currently facing a lot of tough challenges, including a fresh surge in new coronavirus cases, as we've seen in Europe, rising long-term unemployment and a lack of additional government stimulus. Of course, that row still ongoing in the US, and there's no sign of the stimulus package being passed anytime soon. But coming 5 days before Election Day, I think this will be one piece of data which will make the news quite significantly in the US later on today.
Well, you're going to leave us with a other little bit of good news, which is for the car maker Aston Martin.
Yeah, shares in James Bond's favourite car maker racing ahead today, though it doesn't take very much to do that on a day like this, but jumping as much as 16% in early London trading. Now, the company saying that it would raise as much as £1.3 billion through bond and stock offerings, most of which will be used to refinance existing debt. Now, Aston Martin has had a really disastrous 2 years as a public company. It's listed to much fanfare a couple of years ago, but it's really struggled. Part of this announcement today, Mercedes-Benz is to become a major shareholder. It'll help Aston Martin to bring hybrid and electric vehicles to market. So a good bit of news for James Bond's favourite car maker today.
Just need a few people with the salaries to afford them. Let's see if that happens as well. But Ewan, thank you for joining us. That was Bloomberg's Ewan Potts. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's programme, we're going to delve into the world of urbanism. I'm joined to do that by Monocle's Nick Manise. Nick, we're going to begin by talking about one of the stories we heard in the headlines a little earlier about Pakistan's first metro line. What's this?
Yeah, so after years of delay, Lahore, which is the country's second biggest city, I think population of about 11 million people, has just opened its first metro line, the Orange Line, which is 27 kilometres long. It cuts across the city. It's going to shave what was a 2.5-hour bus trip down to 40 45 minutes, which is obviously absolutely brilliant for the people living there. It did, however, cost about 1.5 billion euros, the majority of which did come from China. So there's been a little bit of tension surrounding that, just purely because of the fact that Pakistan as a country has built up billions, tens of billions of euro worth of debt to China as part of its Belt and Road Initiative. But if we're just going to focus on the project, pretty good win for the city.
Well, and amazing if all of these developing nations need to kind of also kind of match what's happening elsewhere in the world about being a bit more environmental, getting people out of cars and onto easier transport. So a good move there. Now, Seattle extending outdoor dining for a year, and it has eased the rules on heaters for winter. A story you and me have been talking about the banal issue of outdoor heaters for some months, because it seems that this is going to be a vital need in lots of countries if they're going to be able to keep any kind of hospitality industry ticking over.
Certainly. I'll be honest, one of my passions, outdoor heating. I helped write the design guide for the city of Perth. Please do look it up and see some of my previous work. But
does Perth need any outdoor heating? I thought it was heated outdoors all the time anyway.
Well, I think it's encouraging people to not enclose their footpaths with drop-down plastic banners, which is another one of our pet peeves. But I think this is quite a good move, just making it easier for people to spend time outside. I mean, previously, to have a heater on a footpath in Seattle, which, you know, has a cold and relatively unpleasant winter, you had to pay the Seattle Fire Department a huge amount and get a special permit. So making these things easier is obviously certainly better in terms of keeping business ticking over. And we've seen numerous other cities do it. I mean, I know Zurich's done it as well in Europe, and New York's done it too in America, making that actually permanent, not even extending it, but building it into their guidelines. So I think this is good, and obviously good for street life in a city too.
Yeah, and even yesterday when I was moving around London yesterday evening, it's amazing how many people are determined still to dine outdoors. There's so many restrictions on dining indoors here. But it was interesting to see how many people were still out drinking and eating outdoors. Now, an issue that's close to my heart, which is the city of Beirut, and a desire to raise some money for what's going on there. So this is 90 architects donating drawings, models, photographs for an auction. What's this?
Yeah, correct. So it's being run by Design Miami, and we've got the likes of Norman Foster. I was just actually having a peruse through to see if I could pick up anything to furnish my home. But Norman Foster's, I mean, I think it's essentially stuff you'd find almost on the floor of a design studio. So we've got sketches, like I said, for the third time, Norman Foster's, a sketch of a school in Africa for $5,000 US. Bernard Schumi, one of his drawings for $1,500. Bjark Engels, another of his drawings for $3,500. So they're quite unique and special. To actually get hold of these is incredibly difficult. You might be able to pick them up in a monograph, but to actually get one that you could frame and hang on your wall is wonderful. And even more wonderful is the fact that all the proceeds, so 100% of them, are going to the Beirut Urban Lab, which is a research centre in Lebanon that since about 2006 has been documenting the city's growth and development. And they're going to obviously help and contribute to this rebuilding process of buildings and public spaces. And I think those sorts of organisations are really important in terms of guiding the rebuild, because having that understanding of what made the city special and maybe even some of the issues that they'd encountered previously is really important in ensuring that it comes back stronger and better.
Now, Nick, here's not a surprising headline, but the London Mayor, Sadiq Khan, is having a tussle with Boris Johnson. What's it about this time?
This is about the congestion zone in the capital where we are. I mean, I think from what I gather, it's more of a war of words. It's a bit of political posturing. We've got a congestion zone here at the moment, and basically Sadiq's suggested that we basically make it 10 times the current size because there's a £2 billion shortfall for transport for London. So that they run the tube and the buses. And they've asked Boris, they've asked the British government for some money to help prop them up, and they need about $2 billion, as I said, and the UK government's only willing to give them one. So what they're hoping to do is essentially force the government's hand by creating, I guess, uproar by making this huge congestion zone that would just cost citizens, anyone driving, £12.50 each time they get in their car.
Well, and it's a complicated issue as well, because it really faces backfiring, because I think that people will blame Sadiq Khan for the changes if they see them there coming from City Hall. What a complicated old world we live in at the moment. Well, Nick, thank you for joining us. As always, great to hear your views on these stories. That was, of course, Monocle's Nick Manise. And that's all we have for this edition of The Briefing. The show was produced by Rhys James and Yulene Goffin, and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the very same time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's time to say thank you, goodbye, and thank you for tuning in.